Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Amy Carey. She is Executive Director of Sound Action, an organization that is focused on bringing science to bear on the permitting process, processes that affect sound health, and ensuring to the extent they can that regulations are followed. Due to the length of our in-depth conversation, this will be part one with part two to follow. Amy Carey, welcome to Climate Talk.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
For sure. So you're the executive director at Sound Action. So I guess I'd like to start off with two separately related things. Who is Amy Carey and what is Sound Action?
Well, I'll start with the Sound Action part.
Okay.
That's a little bit easier. So Sound Action, we're an environmental organization, and we work throughout the Washington State portion of the Salish Sea, from the Canadian border all the way down. And we have a key mission of marine nearshore habitat and species protection with a pretty tight focus on regulatory, both enforcement and action, and how that integrates to protect those habitats and species. And so in our work, we actually review every single permit that's issued by the state of Washington. It's called an hydraulic code approval, an HPA. We review every single one of those permits and take action if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing in protecting marine habitat.
Excuse me for interrupting here real quick, though, but you said if they are not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
So, yeah, I'm sorry. That's under the hydraulic code permit is under the jurisdiction of the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. And
okay.
They are the body that is responsible for processing those permits and protecting habitat.
So just to jump off of that point here for a second, so there is just one agency in the state of Washington that issues those permits?
For that specific permit, the regulatory sort of roadmap can get a little complex in that anytime somebody wants to do project work, either in the water or adjacent to on the shoreline, they're going to need to have local permits, whether that's their city or their county.
Okay.
Then at the state level, depending, so the hydraulic, the HPAs, the hydraulic code, really is kind of the primary state law that's specific to habitat and fish life protection in development permits. But there are also some shoreline development permits that are a little bit different, that are under some of the jurisdiction of the Department of Ecology. And then there's federal permits on top of it. But really, the hydraulic code, as I said, is kind of a just that we envision it like the middle of the wagon wheel, that all the spokes come into it, because every single project, whether you're big or small, that is shoreline and at the waterfront or in the water, requires that HPA. And so it's a way to see every single project that's happening, assuming someone's getting a permit.
So I can gain a little more clarity here. The HPA would overrule any other kind of permitting process. So here's what I'm wondering about. So cities and towns can have their own policies, codes, whatever, regarding to shoreline stuff, I think, right?
Yeah, there's different layers of sort of regulatory laws that are even at the state level. There's the Shoreline Management Act, and in some ways that's more of a land use of what you can or can't do. And then the local jurisdictions have their sort of jurisdiction and authorizations under that umbrella. And then there's the Hydraulic Code, which is its own separate law and separate set of regulations. So those two things are, they don't really have crossover. They're just sort of the difference. If you're, sometimes I try to help folks understand the very sometimes complex regulatory process of, like, think if you're building a house, right? You might need a building permit and you might need a zoning permit or something like that. So there's just different state laws that are specific to shoreline development and shoreline use.
So do we ever see that those are in conflict with each other?
Well, there are certainly some differences and I think some of the, so the Shoreline Management Act, which then, directs what are called shoreline master programs and how those sort of land uses are to be managed on the shorelines. There, that is not necessarily the law that says, it's not as detailed on, for example, things like project specific designs and things like that. There are sometimes, I think, most of the area where there's some conflict or at least some lack of cohesion is as you look to shoreline armoring, because shoreline armoring requires a permit under the state hydraulic code, a very specific, and under these master programs or the SMA, they're given a little bit. Single family residential bulkheads under that law are, they still have to meet certain requirements, but they're given an exemption from the more comprehensive processing. Okay, so there's sometimes some odd little gaps there that are different, or they might use some slightly different wording. But the hydraulic code is really the, we look at that, it's the sort of nuts and bolts of, you know, the requirements for a project, and its focus is the protection of fish life. So there's not a balance that's intended there of development in particular, that's certainly stated in the law. And so under the hydraulic code, a project to be approved is required to protect fish life and the habitat that supports fish life. So it really has that very strong focus on that.
Yeah, it seems complex to me as a layperson. So I'm just wondering, I mean, do you ever think that it could be streamlined and that it could work more efficiently and do a better job of protecting the sound shoreline environment?
There's been, you know, this is sort of always an ongoing discussion of regulatory processes of, you know, how do you strengthen the overreaching process in the first place? And where are those areas? It does become difficult if you don't have continuity or if you have some different things. So there's certainly, I think, always a discussion points and focus on that. But I think the real difference is between like the Shoreline Management Act and the Hydraulic Code is really one is more, has more focus on sort of land use designations, what you can and can't do. For example, they'll create under the Shoreline Management Act and these master programs, they'll take a stretch of shoreline and designate it as, they have these different designations, conservancy, natural, rural, and then depending on what that designation is, can dictate what is allowed as a use in that zone. So I don't think it's the sort of thing where you would want to do away with one or the other because they serve different purposes. I do think that it's always important to try to look to see how you can make things sort of that there's a better synergy to them and that they are acting as intended to be sort of stronger together.
So if somebody's got a project they want to get approval for, so let's say it's fairly extensive, complex. So does this permitting process with these various agencies, does this happen in parallel or is it sequential? Like you got to get A, then B, then C?
Generally, it can be a little bit of both, and I'm sorry for a bit of a gray answer, because you also need a federal permit for projects as well. And so there's nothing in law that says you have to have permit A before you go to permit B to C. So oftentimes you'll see project applicants who are, they'll sort of start the process and they might be applying for putting the applications in at different levels. The local authorization of some level typically comes first. It's in some way because I feel like I'm throwing every environmental law in here too. There's something called SEPA, which is an environmental review process that has to happen before a hydraulic code permit can be issued. And that usually happens at the local level. So that's the complex way of saying that. Typically the local might be the first look, under the regulations that are the SMA and what we'll call the SMPs, Shoreline Master. And then typically folks will be getting the hydraulic code permits are in some ways the least burdensome. They're required by state law to be issued within 45 days. There's not a permit fee. Frankly, those are both things that we'd love to see changed because that's not good practice. Mm-hmm. And then the federal permits are usually the ones that take longer because they have Endangered Species Act review and certainly a, a larger body of laws there as well.
Yeah, you've used the word regulation numerous times. And of course, a lot of people in our culture, our society, view regulation as a dirty word. I don't consider myself amongst those, but I mean, yeah, it's a significant part. But so I'm just thinking the kind of thing that I think we're going to dig into here a little bit about what sound action does.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to imagine any other way of doing that other than through regulation.
Well, I think that's right. And when we, I'll share with you, is just because I think this informs this some. So when we stepped forward as Sound Action, we were born from a previous, certainly entity that had gotten its start as really kind of a community activist group, citizens activist group, that was in opposition to what at the time was proposed to be one of the largest gravel extraction mine sites mm-hmm. in the country, but on the shorelines of Vashon Mori Island. And so, you know, and I know we see those cases all over the place where these sort of large development projects are going in. And what we learned in that, and we won that fight, by the way, it took about 15 years.
Wow.
The Glacier Mori Island Mine, which became a statewide issue. But what we learned through that was these good laws, these environmental laws that were on the books and that were put in place to be kind of at that front line of habitat protection were just regularly discarded. And you would have projects that really, in some cases, shouldn't have been given much, you know, no green lights, and they were just rubber stamped all the way through. And we realized that that was not an isolated issue to just these larger complex developments, but it was something that you see permit by permit and really, you know, establishes that death by a thousand cuts of the Salish Sea and Puget Sound. And so after we won that big fight, you know, we recognized, okay, well, we could all go home, have a big party and go home, but there was so much that needed to be done. And nobody was really filling that role. And so that's when we stepped forward as this watchdog group, recognizing that, you know, this sort of battle, so to speak, for Puget Sound and everything that is supporting really is won or lost on those, you know, I talk about environmental laws being the front lines, right? If a permit's issued without habitat protection, and it's violate, not only is that just a violation of law, it is decimating an already imperiled ecosystem where we have very little left to lose. And so that's why we focus. I know it doesn't sound very sexy to be talking about the regulatory process,
right?
But honestly, this is the bullseye of where it comes down to. If we win or lose, for salmon or orcas, forage fish, all of that, this is where it is.
Yeah, and that kind of points to why folks who aren't so concerned about that, and they're more about the habitats and the species and so on, they're more concerned about making some bucks. That's why they find regulations irritating, because those regulations are going to at least restrict possibly what they're going to be able to do in their industry.
Yeah, and I think there's also, I mean, it is an interesting thing with the hydraulic code is that it, because it covers everything, it's industry, it's private parties, it's, you know, even state agencies who are doing, you know, development work need a permit. So we had to get a permit recently for this underwater camera that we put in that I can talk about later. So that was interesting too, being on the, walking through the process. you know, and I have to say, I mean, I tend to try to be an optimist. And I recognize, you know, that there are people who regulations they can kind of have a stiffening to. But honestly, when we have the opportunity to be speaking more directly with people, and in some cases, the project applicants who are on the other side of a project that we might have appealed, I see as much people who are wanting to do the right thing. Mm. And they are looking to these agencies and putting their trust to say, I need you to tell me what to do. And I think when they understand too why it matters, for example, you're, you know, connecting that your dock, your private residential dock is damaging habitat and oftentimes in a significant way. And so once people realize some of that, I see there's as much of that. You're always going to have, much like the country division, right? There are people who are always going to be the property rights, don't tell me what to do, all of that stuff. But I think there's as much support for appropriate environmental protections.
Yeah, you used the word optimism there just a minute ago. And so I can see why that would be appropriate in this case, because it is easy for me, and I think for a lot of people, to just categorize various groups and say, well, everybody in that group is that way. And it's reassuring and refreshing to hear you say that there are people seeking permits and they're going in with the perspective of like, okay, I really want to do this right. And I'm going to be looking at that throughout this process. So that is a source of optimism.
There are. Now, I also want to be realistic on that. I would say that's not a high percentage of, you're going to have all sorts of shades there. You're going to have people who are saying, hey, I want to do this. Or sometimes it's people who are putting permits in to remove a damaging structure, right? That's an old bulkhead or something. So you'll have shades, all of that. But I do think that particularly with Puget Sound and the sort of greater Salish Sea here, these laws are not just because somebody thinks they're, right. When we look, we all know, we can see, we can look to, sort of our orcas who are kind of they're this iconic example, and people know we're not talking about a water body and different species that are doing just fine. We have a very small window where we might be able to turn things around. And so I think that there's certainly more awareness too, that this is an ecosystem that is in grave trouble.
Yeah, well, more on that here in a minute. So you made some reference to the initial project that got your organization going on Vashon and Mori. So what year was that approximately that took place?
Well, so it started in 93, I think. And I was not involved in the very beginning of that organization. Mm-hmm. But it was this great example of, honestly, I think where change really happens, where you had this large multinational company coming in saying, we're going to do this thing. It was very damaging to the shoreline. It was basically opening an industrial operation. And in this really almost like a habitat oasis, in that there was still some very healthy functioning habitat there. And they thought, oh, well, we'll be up and running in, 90 days sort of thing.
Whoa.
Right. I mean, it was that, and what you had was people in the community saying, that doesn't seem right. And where I really often see change happen is three people at a kitchen table saying, well, I think we better do something. And starting that, the power of grassroots organizing, and it became what started very locally expanded, because Puget Sound is everybody's backyard, right? All of these things. And it became a statewide issue. It became in some ways we had federal representatives that were working on it as well. We filed the first Endangered Species Act lawsuit for orcas had just been listed, and we won. One of the few, federal lawsuits are almost impossible to win, and we won on that case. And so I stepped into a leadership role there in about 2007. And so I was, walking it through those sort of where it had come to the regulatory challenges there in the end. And ultimately, after that legal suit, and they kind of were directed that they had to go back to do different environmental impact statements. And then we started working on purchasing the property with King, so King County, it's now a park, basically, the whole property. So, but that was just such an example of what happens when nobody's looking in the first place, right? What if there was nobody who said, hey, that's not right? And how you bring change.
So what is the name of the park?
When I say park, it's actually a natural area. it's on the shoreline of Maury Island. And so there's now an area they've built onto the land there, or they've been, you know, creating. So the Maury Island Marine Park and Natural Area create this. It's about a mile or so of shoreline along Southeast Maury Island.
So I know that place. I was starting to wonder. So of course I had no knowledge of the history of that spot. So it's kind of got this long gravel road that goes maybe half a mile from.
So that's a section of it, which, much like the regulatory process, the backstory is also very complicated and convoluted. So the Maury Island, the one that has the road that goes down, was also historically had been a much smaller, some gravel mining there in the 70s. And then the area that was the glacier site, which was the sort of big fight site, is just a little bit to the southwest of there.
Got it. Yeah.
And you can't drive down, but you can down.
Yeah.
And it's got a much bigger pit structure there from where they did do some mining in the 70s as well. But the Maury Island Natural Area was an acquisition that started, you know, really in relationship to when we were in the heart of the glacier fight, the Maury Island fight. There was some funding that had been set aside for hopeful purchase of the proposed, you know, barging operation site that was used to help secure some of these other properties until we finally had they had changed their name. They're now CalPortland, willing to sell the larger project.
Well, anyway, congratulations.
Yeah.
Far after the time, but, and you know, it's interesting that so many people can enjoy that natural environment there and not have a clue of why it's still
what
there,
yeah.
Including me and that group. So I started off saying, we want to know a little bit about, Amy Carey and we've gotten into the weeds here a bit, which has been great. I love it. But, so we know a bit about how you got started in this from that particular project. So what is it what's your background and what's drawn you to this kind of work?
Well, you know, it's funny. I grew up in Iowa in the middle of cornfields, about the farthest from any, you know, didn't see the ocean until I was 18. And it was out here. I had a friend who had moved out to Seattle, and I came out here and she took me to La Push for the first time. And I remember seeing purple starfish, and I was just mesmerized, because for me, a kid in the Midwest, a starfish was a dried brown up thing, you know, thing that somebody brought back from a gift shop, you know, that sort of thing. So I was just, it was instantly home. And I think one of those things, like I can't really explain, you know, how that switch happened otherwise, other than just it this was home, and these things were just so felt a part of me. And with that came orcas. And, you know, if you care about orcas, you have to care about everything down to the tiniest grain of sand. I joke a little bit that orcas are sort of the gateway species drug into environmental protection. And so, you know, I moved out here in, I think, 92. And started really more focusing on environmental work. Probably really the glacier fight is what launched me fully into the sort of boots on the ground doing it. And you know, that is, it's still, you know, doing the work for the protection. There's something usually every day that reminds me of how important it is. Even if I'm out doing field work, doing a site review, you know, getting forage fish study report, something like that. There's all these reminders of how very, very important it is.
So you made reference a little while ago. I think you used a phrase something like a ever narrowing window of opportunity to bring the sound back, or something like that. So talk more about that. I mean, where are we in terms of the health of the sound?
We're losing that fight desperately.
We are losing that fight. An opinion from someone who has spent many years of her adult life understanding what's going on with the sound that looks so great on the surface, but which is in ever-declining health. Next episode, we'll be picking up our conversation with Amy Carey of Sound Action as she fills in the blanks of what the situation is in the sound, what the trends have been, where we're headed, and what we as ordinary citizens can do to make things better. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. CCO part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.